The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, our affiliate stations, or CJSR.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Now, we have a very special guest today, Adam Savage of TV's Mythbusters, and we're all ridiculously excited. But Mr. Savage is a very busy man. He can only appear for the last half of this show. So just keep your pants on, because we have someone else with us who is also awesome. Derek Bartholomew, creator of the website The Jenny McCarthy Body Count, is now on the line. Derek,
Hello.
Are you there? Hi, Derek. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
Derek is a member of the Los Angeles-based Independent Investigations Group, otherwise known as IIG. The IIG's mission is to investigate fringe science, paranormal and extraordinary claims from a rational, scientific viewpoint, and also to get that information out to the public. Derek is also the creator of the Jenny McCarthy Body Count website. Now, the site was officially launched on March 29th, 2009, and initially he only told people about it through Twitter and Facebook. But during the very first week, it was linked to by Bad Astronomy, Ferengula, the Randy websites, and was viewed by over 10,000 people. So in less than 6 months of its existence, the website has now been viewed by over 125,000 people. Good on you, Derek.
Thank you. I was a bit shocked at the reaction. I thought that it would be of interest to people in the skeptical community, but I didn't expect the huge reaction that it got.
Well, tell us about the website.
Well, what it is, Jenny McCarthy has become the unofficial head of the U.S. anti-vaccination movement. And it was in June of 2007 that she came out as an anti-vaccinationist and started telling parents not to vaccinate their children for the mistaken belief that vaccines cause autism. She has a child who is autistic, and that is where she got that idea from. You know, that's why she's an advocate for it.
Right.
This. And so what the site does is that it tracks every vaccine-preventable illness and death that has occurred since she started telling people not to vaccinate their children.
So
it's important to understand that I don't think that she is responsible for all of these, but she certainly is an influencing factor.
So the site tracks the total number of vaccine-preventable illnesses and vaccine-preventable deaths that have happened since June 2007, right?
Right.
So is there an actual correlation between when she started publicly campaigning and when we started to see a rise?
Well, there is definitely a rise that has happened in the last couple of years, especially with measles, mumps, and rubella. There is a on the website, I have a page called Illness Timelines. And if you look at that, you'll see that there is a very large jump that happened starting in 2007. And the only thing that happened during that time is she started telling people not to vaccinate their children. So again, you know, correlation does not equal causation.
Mm-hmm.
But there is definitely a correlation between
right.
when she started telling people not to vaccinate their children and the number of outbreaks that have happened, especially with measles, mumps, and rubella.
Now, audience, if you'd like to call in and ask a question about the Jenny McCarthy Body Count website or the anti-vaccination movement, or would just like to say hello, we have a special means of communication for this week's show, so don't call into the regular phone number. You can actually Skype in today by connecting to Skeptically Speaking, or you can call 1-909-366-5330. And as usual, you can also email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com. So, Derek, how do you track this?
I use the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Reports. To back up a little bit, during 2008, you know, Steve Novella and Phil Plait would be talking a lot about Jenny McCarthy, and Steve Novella is the one that actually started saying that she had a body count attached to her. And then in January of this year, they, on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, they had a big discussion about her. And then I just decided, like, I wonder what that body count is. And then I went and registered the domain names and then asked Steve and Phil and Jim Underdown, who's the executive director of the Center for Inquiry in L.A., and the chair of the IIG. And it was Jim that told me about the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. He subscribed to it as a conversation piece back when it was a print journal. And but now everything's online, and then I just started going through and calculating everything based on which of the diseases. The report tracks all sorts of diseases. And what I track are the diseases that have vaccines for them. Diphtheria, I'm going to really screw up some of the pronunciations of these. Haemophilus influenzae serotype B, otherwise known as HIB, influenza-associated pediatric mortality, measles, meningococcal disease, ACY and W135, mumps, two different types of polio, rubella, tetanus, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, pertussis, and varicella, which is chickenpox. So we have vaccines for all of those.
Right.
And so I go through and add up all the numbers every week with the when the report comes out on Saturdays.
So can we actually attribute all of these cases to people not being vaccinated?
No. What the one thing is, you know, vaccines are not 100% effective. So you can be vaccinated and still get a disease. And so that would show up on the weekly report. Then there's also, but what I've found is whenever there's an outbreak, the index patient has been an unvaccinated individual, most likely a child.
After you got this site launched, do people now ask you why they should believe you over Jenny McCarthy, being neither of you are doctors?
I've received primarily just lots of people being thankful. I actually have not received any hate mail over this, which is kind of surprising given some of the vitriol that people like Orac and Phil Plait and Steve Novella have received.
Right.
But I think the main reason that I haven't gotten that amount of vitriol is because it's not a blog. You can't comment on it. You actually have to open up your email program and write to me.
Brilliant
which
choice.
Apparently is just that one step of effort that a lot of people don't want to engage in, apparently.
Hmm. Well, have Jenny's people ever contacted you?
No.
No threatening letters?
No, none whatsoever. I don't know if she's seen it. I would kind of guess that she would have by now, because if you do a Google search for Jenny McCarthy, I show up on the front page.
Absolutely. I think you're the fourth or the fifth down.
Yeah, I run between number four and number seven, depending on when you search, which is huge.
That's amazing, actually. Okay, so the site is named after Jenny McCarthy, but you've said it's not about her per se. She's just the most high-profile anti-vaccination proponent.
Right. In the U.S., Andrew Wakefield is really the one most to blame for the rise in people not vaccinating their children.
Can you tell us a bit about him?
Andrew Wakefield is a guy in Britain who wrote an article in the, I think it was 97 or 98, that said that vaccines cause autism. And it created a huge panic in England. And then that belief got filtered to other parts around the world. And as bad as the anti-vaccination nonsense is in the United States, it's not as bad as, from what I've been able to understand, as it is in the UK and Australia.
Right.
I don't know how it is in Canada.
It doesn't seem to be as bad as it is other places. We're very polite here.
Well, that's always good.
It helps in some things. And again, audience, we're here with Derek Bartholomew, creator of the website The Jenny McCarthy Body Count. And again, the extra special way to reach us is by connecting to Skeptically Speaking on Skype or calling 1-909-366-5330 or, as always, emailing live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Now, let's talk about vaccines for a second. Now, Jenny continually points out that more studies need to be done into the safety and the timing and such. So what kind of research has been done into this? Where does the evidence lie?
Well, it appears as though nothing has been tested as much as vaccines. And the one thing that we do know is, now, first, I have to point out, I'm not a doctor. I work in the entertainment industry, and I made a website. The actual experts are people like Joe Albeats and Stephen Novella and people like that, and, you know, people who actually have studied medicine. But what I have been able to learn is, like, you know, I wasn't involved in vaccine or anti-vaccination history or anything until I created the site and then started researching stuff. So what I have been able to see, though, is that we have tested vaccines very, very, very thoroughly, and they do not have any correlation to autism. They've changed their story. It's the moving the goalpost logical fallacy that occurs, where originally it was the MMR vaccine. And then it was thimerosal. And then it was like, now it's greening the vaccines and getting rid of the toxic chemicals, which is humorous from a person. Jenny McCarthy is a advocate and speaks out regularly about regular Botox use.
Yes, yes. It's interesting, the inconsistency.
Yes, putting the theoretical, you know, the mythological toxins that appear in vaccines, or putting the deadliest toxin on the planet into your face. I mean,
I believe this is known as cognitive dissonance.
Right.
We actually have an email from a listener.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's going to be read by our intern, Ryan. You go ahead.
Okay, this is from Susie, and she says, speaking as a concerned skeptic and pro-vax parent, I just wondered if you've seen a constant increase in the number of infections, or has there been a slowing of seeing new disease outbreaks in the past few months? Especially since the article in Time against Oprah, supported of Jenny, and Wu Medicine, any chance that vaccinations are going back up?
It's too soon to tell. The Centers for Disease Control, one of the things that I think I have an undercount on the number of deaths.
Really?
And the reason being is that the illnesses have to be reported every week, but the deaths only get announced annually 3 years after the date. So I won't get final death data until 2010 for what happened in 2007.
Right.
So what about 99% of the deaths that are listed on the site are due to influenza-associated pediatric mortality. You know, people who died from the flu who were under 18. There are a couple of instances where in a different part of the weekly report, it mentioned, you know, a child dying of, I can't remember which one, I think it wasn't pertussis, but there was someone in the early part of this year, there was a child who died from one of the other illnesses that are vaccine preventable.
Right.
But the actual breakdown of how many people died of what at what time is only released annually.
Okay.
So once that comes out, which, again, it won't be until 2010 before I get the 2007 data, because they just released the 2006 data this summer.
That's frightening,
so,
sir.
I fear that that number is actually going to increase once that report is released.
So what do you say to people that are convinced that this is some kind of cover-up? That you can't see them, I'm using air quotes, Big Pharma is suppressing the studies showing that vaccines are dangerous.
Well, here's the thing, actually, because there is a lot of talk about Big Pharma and that they make money off of vaccines, and it's all a big way to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the concerns that have happened since the late 90s, companies have stopped making vaccines. We, about, you know, 10, 20 years ago, there were around 10 companies that made vaccines in the United States. And today, I believe it's four. And the only reason that those four are still doing it is because the U.S. government is paying them to do so. Because they realized it's not a good idea to not have vaccines made in the U.S. You know, they need to make sure that someone is making them. So, yes, you know, the companies make money, but they're not making huge profits,
right,
off of vaccines. Where they make huge profits is if these diseases come back, because the actual treatment of a disease such as polio or pertussis or, you know, in things along that line, you make a lot more money. The drugs that are used to deal with those diseases and treat those diseases are a lot more expensive than the cost of a vaccine.
Well, you know, not to get too far off into conspiracy theory territory, but it seems like a lot of people talk about, you know, the suppression itself. So not just the profits, but that there's an actual suppression going on of these studies. Which, thinking about it, that implies that every single researcher in this area is being bought off initially, and that they actually have to keep their mouth shut afterwards. So that every researcher in this area is horrible, but amazingly disciplined. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and it's sad. There's over the last 20, 30 years in the U.S., specifically, I don't know how it works in other countries, but there has been a denigration of education that has happened. And I believe that this denigration has led to people believing many things which aren't provably not true.
Right.
And it's going to take decades of increased education to eliminate that. And it's really, you know, I think it's Mark Twain that said, you know, a lie can make its way around the world before the truth can put its shoes on.
Right.
And it's just horrible that those of us on the rational side, you know, the reality-based community, we have to work so much harder to get people to listen to us when someone can just say a lie not even necessarily a lie, but just something that is not true, something
right,
that they are just wrong about. And they can run circles around us, and we just constantly are trying to catch up.
Well, that's what we're doing tonight. And we actually have a caller on the line. I believe it's Kim from Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, it can be really hard to broach these hot-button topics with people, especially when you don't want to create animosity. So what do you think is a good approach when talking to friends who are against vaccinating because of Jenny's campaign?
It's very tough. I've been lucky that I don't have close friends who are anti-vaccine, but a friend of mine a husband and wife who are in the independent investigations group, they just had a child, and they discovered lots of their friends who are anti-vaccine, and it became very frustrating and disappointing to learn that. What they did is they told them, he's like, you know what? These are, you know, you need to do this. This is not just, vaccines are not for the, just for the safety of the child. It's for the safety of the community. Because if the community doesn't get vaccinated, then many people can suffer. Because there is a certain percentage of the population that, for medical reasons, cannot be vaccinated. The numbers vary, but it's usually between 3-5% of people that just actually cannot be vaccinated. So they rely on everyone else to be vaccinated in order to protect them. And this is what's known as herd immunity. And generally, it varies from disease to disease, but generally it's around you need 90% of the population to be vaccinated in order to have herd immunity. And when you have 3-5% that can't be vaccinated, and then you have 3-5% that won't be vaccinated, you're already on the edge. And what happens is, in these outbreaks that have occurred, they've been in clusters there have been in communities where the people weren't vaccinated, you know. And what's also interesting is that it's generally the more affluent communities that are the most anti-vaccine.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. I read somewhere, I can't remember where this was, but that there's a percentage of the population that will just believe something which is incorrect. But what that incorrect belief is, changes. Depending on education, which is bizarre.
Right.
So we keep thinking, it's like, oh, the more educated you get, the less likely you're going to be taken in, and it's just not true. You're just going to get taken in by something else.
So we actually have another email.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Ryan.
It is, have you seen StopJenny.com? Any plans to reach out to other sites to target Jenny's claims and network?
Oh yeah. No, I spoke to the people at Stop Jenny before I launched the site. And so they linked to me and I linked to them. No, they're great. They've been at this a lot longer than I have.
Wonderful. It's a small community. So
yeah.
I definitely think we've all been very supportive of each other. What did you call them? The reality-based community.
Yeah, the reality-based community.
I'm going to start using that. So why do you think the public is more willing to believe celebrities than medical professionals?
I honestly don't know. We tend to give importance to people that we see a lot. And we see actors on TV a lot. It may harken back to the ads, and I forget the actor's name, but the guy who played Marcus Welby.
Right.
You know, when he did commercials, he always had to say, he's like, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. And then would go on to say something, you know, to sell some product. I wish I knew why we would pay attention to celebrities more than physicians. Because we really shouldn't. Even Amanda Peet, who has kind of been, you know, the anti-Jenny McCarthy.
Exactly.
She said, you know, the IIG actually holds an annual awards show for good and bad presentations of skepticism in entertainment. And we gave a special award to her this last year because of her pro-vaccine stance. And in one of the clips that we showed, she told people, it's like, I understand that this is a bit odd, but you shouldn't be listening to me. She's like, you shouldn't be listening to celebrities.
Right.
You should be listening to your doctor.
Because it's a bit of a double standard that we love Amanda Peet.
Oh, yeah, she's great.
But
A, she's a great actress, and B, she's on, you know, she's not dumb.
Right, right. Succinct, sir. So do you think that doctors or scientists can do anything about the fact that some people seem to be opposed to, I'm going to use air quotes again, this doesn't translate well on radio, Western medicine, or, you know, they just don't trust science as a whole?
I think they do. This year I went to the Amazing Meeting, and it was the first time I'd ever attended, and it was amazing. And I met several doctors when I was there, and all of them said, you know, they try. They will do anything that they can to keep that patient in the office and to try to slowly work with them to get them to accept medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one doctor said that he's had twice in his career, he's had to tell a person, you need to go somewhere else, because a person just refused to want to have anything to do with Western medicine or vaccines or any sort of, you know, diagnostic help. And he's like, there's absolutely nothing I can do for you. You're going to have to go to someone else. We'll do nothing but fight the entire time. And it's not good for you, and it's not good for me. And so it was interesting to hear that. That was, you know, the most dire form of that conversation that I had. But
so really, the
generally
best thing...
the doctors keep the patient, you know, try to not, you never want to tell the patient, you know, you're wrong or you're stupid. You need to find ways of getting them to stay in the office and get them the information so that they can get the information eventually into them.
And, you know, of course, through people like us.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I think we, you know, all of us that in the skeptical community are doing what we can. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see that the skeptical community in the last couple of years has decided not to be quiet. Which has been great with the advent of podcasting and blogging and stuff like that.
Agreed.
I think everybody has been at the point where they thought they were the only one in their community, and in the last few years they realized they're not.
Brilliant. And on that note, thanks for being here, Derek.
Well, thank you so much.
No, absolutely. And that was Derek Bartholomew, creator of the website The Jenny McCarthy Body Count. And you can check that out for yourself at jennymccarthybodycount.com. And we will be right back with Adam Savage, Mythbuster, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, @skepticalradio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking with Brian Mallow, Earth's premier science comedian. We'll be discussing the irony of infectious diseases, the comedic implications of cosmology, and what's so funny about the second law of thermodynamics. Call in and question everything on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Hello, faithful listeners. Desiree here, host of Skeptically Speaking, the show that interviews the experts and offers you the opportunity to get involved in the conversation. The show that lets you speak personally to people like Phil Plate, Richard Saunders, and Adam Savage. The show that asks you to call in and question everything. And I bring this up because next week I'll be asking you to call in for another reason: to donate money. CJSR, the community radio station that allows Skeptically Speaking to use their studio and their equipment and their airwaves, is holding their annual fundraising campaign, Fund Drive. If you listen to Skeptically Speaking and you appreciate what we're doing here, please donate. There aren't that many radio stations that would allow us to bring this kind of skeptical material to you, especially live. So please help us show them that this kind of programming is necessary and welcome and loved. CJSR's Fund Drive, September 23rd to October 3rd. Phone 780-492-2577, extension 1 to donate, or you can do it online at cjsr.com. We now return you to Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we are live with Adam Savage, one of the hosts of TV's Mythbusters. Are you there, Adam?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So before we get to the interview, I just want to point out that I sent Adam a somewhat emotional request to be on Skeptically Speaking. Mainly because CJSR's fundraising campaign starts next week, and we need money. And Adam, who is what is commonly known as a big star, responded not only promptly, but enthusiastically. So, thank you, sir. I want everyone to know that you are not only amazing for your science-y hotness, but just you're a very lovely human being.
Well, shucks, thanks so much.
No, thanks very much for being here. So, this is interesting. I don't have any questions of my own today. This is unusual.
Okay.
Because the show was, well, let's say figuratively, bombarded with emails from people who have questions for you.
Oh, excellent.
So, I've culled the best ones. And if you in the non-studio audience out there have a question of your own, do Skype us at Skeptically Speaking. You can also call us at 1-909-366-5330, or you can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since Adam needs no introduction, we'll get right into it. So we're going to start with a question that showed up over and over in various emails. What was your favorite explosion?
My favorite explosion? Yeah, at this point, we've done so many of them, we end up sort of feeling like wine connoisseurs of explosions. You know how, like, even in chocolate tasting, they have very specific terminology about snap and the last and all of this kind of thing. It really happens the same way with explosions. Like, you know, we might say something like, oh, that one had a really good, sharp snap at the beginning with a deep thud, and it lasted for a while. And we tend to like the ones that you can feel more. Those tend to be just more interesting. And honestly, my favorite thing to watch blow up is not even technically an explosion. I think technically it's more of what physicists would call a conflagration. And that's watching the water heaters go.
Water
heaters are our single favorite thing to blow up. They are really exquisite and so much fun.
That's a beautiful answer. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that explosions were like wine.
You've kind of... Well, there's so many different kinds. I mean, you've got your high explosives, your low explosives, the length of the reaction. There are explosives meant for cutting. There are explosives meant for pushing. They all do different things, and they're all meant to be used in different circumstances. And so they all feel differently depending on where you are and what you've asked them to do. Yeah, it's really quite remarkable.
Was there ever a myth that you were actually afraid of completing or testing?
Yeah, there's been, well, I mean, on many of them, we're scared. I mean, remember that we're most of these stories, most of the good stories are about people getting hurt in certain circumstances. And so we're being asked to set up those circumstances and watch them as closely as possible with lots of camera equipment and hopefully ourselves if it's safe. And you can, you know, we've now done something like 175 hours of the show, and we've done something like 2,000 separate experiments. There's a point at which you start to feel like your number's up. We were out on site yesterday doing some stuff, and we were just about to do something and we stopped. And we're like, you know what? Let's stop doing it this way and let's do it in a different way. Because although it seems like it's going to be fine, we want to add an extra layer of safety to it at this point. And so we have that fear. It's kind of like a good carpenter is always a little bit spooked when he's using the table saw. It's never not a scary thing to use. That being said, we did some research into a story a while back about a trunk full of liquid oxygen turning over and spilling all of its contents on a road surface. And then the road surface basically became a high explosive once the asphalt came in contact with the locks. And we did some small experimenting with liquid oxygen, enough to notice that it was definitely very explosive and super unpredictable. It's actually probably one of the scariest materials we've ever played with. And we got into it enough to take a look at the full structure of the experiment and decided not to go for it.
Right. Well, that's probably for the best. You know your limits.
Yeah, that's the way we look at it.
And we actually have a caller on the line. We have Steve from the Niagara region, which I think is in Ontario.
Yeah, it is from the Ontario region of Canada region. Yeah, my name's Steve Toms. I do the blog Some Canadian Skeptic. I had to plug, you understand. So, first of all, Adam, thanks for doing this. I think that's just a really super cool thing to do. But I do have two questions, and one's a little bit more open-ended than the other. Now, I notice you guys have a really hands-on kind of crew there. Like, you'll have the cast helping out with the build, but you'll also have interns and researchers, and I've seen children paint every now and then, too.
Yeah.
Super adorable. But I wonder about when you guys will char the side of a mountain or when you'll smash two transport trucks together, who cleans up? Does the cast just kind of take off and leave it for the interns, or do you got cleanup companies? What's the cleanup like?
Yeah, the answer is all of the above. We've done the cleanup. We've had members of our crew do the cleanup. We have hired professional cleanup companies to do the cleanup. Sometimes we film in places where the cleanup is part of the price of us showing up and using their facilities. In the beginning, Jamie and I did a lot more of the cleanup, but as the production schedule gets tighter and they want more episodes and we produce more, we actually finally got a guy, Don Best, about 2 years ago to start helping us clean up the shop. And until then, we were doing all the cleanup prior to every myth, which just was seemed like a poor use of our time.
Super, okay. Now, the other question, this has been bugging me for a couple of years. There was the episode, I think it was something like Rocket Car or something like that, where you had brought in Scotty back to build that big ramp, and you put the big rocket at the end of the car, and the rocket was about to go, and then it exploded, and you had this flaming car corpse lying around, and you're all standing around it, and you hear Jamie say, "Well, somebody owes me $10,000," and everybody kind of chuckled at that.
That was me. I said that, by the way.
Oh, that was...
Ooh.
Well, what happened?
Excited.
Rocketry is, what are you going to say? It's not rocket science. The guys that built that rocket build those rockets all the time. Unfortunately, every now and then, a batch will not be perfect, and then it will blow up on the stand. You can buy rockets that will be where every rocket is from a batch that's been tested, so you're much more guaranteed that it'll work perfectly, but those rockets cost twice as much. So, in fact, when I said $10,000, actually, it was $10,000 per rocket. It was $20,000 worth of rockets that blew up. And if we'd wanted a guarantee that those rockets would operate every time, I think the price was around more like $35,000. And that was outside of our budget. That was already, I think, one of the most expensive episodes we've ever produced. And it was sad. It was very sad. I have to say, though, on a positive note for us, it was really satisfying to know that with all the systems that we had to make work, our systems worked beautifully. We actually took some satisfaction. See, for us, the problem solving in and of itself is the thrilling part. The icing on the cake, the car taking off is great, but for us, having all those systems work perfectly and knowing that the failure wasn't on anything that we had done actually we're both quite satisfied with how that played out. Now, that being said, the guys that built those rockets, I believe, have made an offer that at some point in the future, if we want to do it again, we'll get a good, deep discount on the rocket. So it may come up again. We may try that myth one more time.
I really hope so, because that was really rad.
Thanks so very much for calling, Steve.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I believe we have another email.
We actually had two emails, but they're essentially the same question. So I'll read the longer one. We love you guys. You're truly the Mr. Wizards for this generation. Thank you for teaching the scientific method to people. Is there any movie/TV illusion that M5 helped create that you have or would love to bust? And most importantly, can you please blow up 2 cement trucks at once this year?
Well, if we had a reason to blow up 2 cement trucks at once, I'm sure we would do it. But I don't currently have one on the top of my head. What was the first question again, though?
It was, is there any movie/TV illusion that M5 helped create that you would that you have or would love to bust?
Oh, that we'd love to bust. Interesting. Well, you know, the movie stuff where we really get our hands dirty is the stunt work. It's the car stunts, it's the physical stunts. And for the most part, much of what M5 and I are two different entities. I did a lot of special effects work for Lucasfilm and for Warner Brothers on the Matrix films, stuff like that. And actually, you know, the second 2 Matrix films, the physics in those are, well, forgetting the fact that the Sentinels can't fly, or there's no reason I can figure why they fly, a lot of the crashes in the finale of the Matrix films is actually pretty physically sound, I think. I was there when they crashed the Mjolnir through the big doors. It was pretty spectacular. But you know, if it comes up to be part of a story that a movie that we worked on turns out to be something that we're actually tackling on the show, I think we'd be absolutely thrilled. It hasn't come up yet.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, we have wow, the emails are piling up here. The this question is from actually our fantastic photographer, Mark Julian, so he gets in first. You guys are great at handling sensitive topics tastefully. Do you think it would be possible, both technically and politically, to do a show or segment on misconceptions surrounding radiocarbon dating?
Well, that falls into a weird category. I mean, what misconceptions are there out there about radiocarbon dating? I believe that some people feel that it violates their religious beliefs because it states the world is older than they want to believe it is. But besides that, I don't know of any conflict in the scientific community about radiocarbon dating. Thus, yeah, I'll have to take a look at that one in more detail. We're not really into necessarily preaching to the choir. And actually getting into radiocarbon dating is quite esoteric, and I'm not sure it's very visual from an our show standpoint.
Mm-hmm. We actually have a lot of religious questions, which I chose to avoid completely except for this one because this was vaguely science-based. We have another email question. Go ahead, Ryan.
And this is from Paul, and he asks, who built Jamie, and how often do you need to send him out for maintenance?
That's cute.
Yes. Yeah, no, that is still a secret, and I don't know about his maintenance schedule. It's not even something that I'm privy to.
I bet you're making a lot of money off that patent right there. So, let me see. How about, I really want to make sure I get to this question because it was very cute. It was sent in. It was very misspelled. I'm a 14-year-old girl, and I want to be as good at building robots as Grant is on the show. What should I do?
The first recipe for being good at anything is to get obsessed with it. Someone told me this a long time ago. She worked at a gallery in New York with painters, sculptors, illustrators. She said, you know, everybody who makes a living making art, which is one of the hardest possible ways to make a living, she said, you know, and they all come from different walks of life and different backgrounds, different makeups, different psychological profiles, but the thing that unites them all is that they're obsessed with what they do, and they're obsessed with everybody else that's doing it too. You know, once you start to dive into a subject, and start to, the more you read about a subject, the more you dive into it, the more you start to tease out the important bit. I mean, you know, Grant, I think, would be the first one to tell you that 95% of his robot building is problems solved stemming from maybe four or five root principles that are quite simple. And that last 5% is where things get really interesting and where the problem solving becomes really fascinating.
Right.
And watching how other people solve those problems, taking apart lots and lots and lots of stuff. I mean, I took apart so many things. I would buy things at garage sales just to take them apart. And you do that enough, you start to realize how they go back together, and there's no better way to learn how things work. Jamie and I once had a lovely afternoon in the shop when we were doing a stunt, and I had dunked one of his winches in the water, and he'd gotten a little pissed off, and I was like, don't get pissed off, I'll clean it out, don't worry about it. So the next morning I showed up, and he handed me this bucket with the winch in it, and I took it out and started taking it apart to clean it and re-grease it and repack it and stuff. And I was looking at it, and he saw me looking at it, and he said, yeah. And I said, this is interesting. And he said, yeah, tell me, take a look inside there and tell me how you think it works. And I was like, oh, yeah, because it's not as simple as I thought. And I was taking a careful look. And in the end, I stared at it for about half an hour before I realized what the mechanism was. And he asked me if I wanted hints. And I was like, nope, I don't want hints. And I stared at it. Finally, I got it right. I figured it out. And I mean, there are a few better feelings than being able to understand the innovations that someone has brought to bear on a specific problem.
Well, 14-year-old girl, I hope that helped. We have a call on the line. It's Kevin from Edmonton.
Hi.
Hi, Kevin.
Huge fan.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, of both shows. kind of, how do you choose which myth you're going to test?
You know, it's a constantly evolving process. There are some stories which are just, you know, home runs, and you got to do them. There are things like, you know, airplane on a conveyor belt. Once we saw that, we knew we had to try it. lead balloon, rocket car. I mean, these are ones that the moment you see them, you instantly understand about 80% of how the episode's going to go. There are other ones that aren't so simple. We were doing one recently, which will air soon, in the fall, where we actually had this myth on the list called Hang On There. And we worked out the outline for it a whole bunch of times. And it's basically myths about, you know, could you really hang off a building with one hand holding on to the girl? Could you lift yourself up? Could you lift your buddy up? Could you catch yourself? All these tropes we see in action movies towards the finale, are they really physically possible? And we have this whole outline built where we try it, and then we bring in a parkour expert and a rock boulder and stuff like that. And, you know, we try it in different circumstances and do different setups with it. But one of the problems with it as a myth is that it's difficult to figure out what the finale is. I mean, if it's just people hanging off and stuff, what's your big close? The opening's interesting, but how do you finish it off? And I started thinking about it, and I realized, you know, in movies, people are always jumping into dumpsters. Neo does it in The Matrix. Butch escapes from the boxing ring in Pulp Fiction that way. How safe is it really to jump into a dumpster? And so we started peeling that one apart. We called it dumpster diving. And we're like, well, you know, you go out to the dump, you take a look at various dumpsters, you see what's in them. Then you get to do something I've always wanted to do, which is you get trained how to fall by a stuntman. And by the time we were done peeling apart what was supposed to be the finale of Hang On There, we realized we could chuck Hang On There and do a whole half episode on dumpster diving. Like, it was that good. So one of the things that's happening more and more lately is that we start to pick apart stories to figure out what their component parts are. Jamie and I will hone in on a single component part and realize there's a whole story in there. And then we've got, you know, two stories where formerly we had one, or three where we had one.
So, so
that's the most fun part for us about how the process evolved.
Also, there's a... kind of with my job with the Wilderness Committee, I'm running a campaign to protect ground squirrels. And one of
What's
the myths I keep coming
here?
Across is cows breaking their legs in the holes. Any ideas on how to test that myth and kind of pitch it for the show?
Wait. What's the myth? The myth is that cows and what?
That cows and horses break their legs in gopher holes.
Oh, cows and horses break their legs. Wow. interesting. Well, I mean, of course, we could couple that with cow tipping, which has been on our list forever. The problem with it is we're totally disinterested in herding cows. Herding, not herding. But I mean, I suppose the way we'd start to do, you'd have to build a full mechanical cow and stick his leg and see how he'd respond. That's tough. But really, like I said, cow tipping's been on our list forever to figure out a safe way to do it without hurting a cow. And that's one of the other ways we look for stories. If a story turns out to maybe not be thrilling enough for a full episode, it might couple up very nicely with one or two or three other stories that we've had for a long time that also fall into that same category.
So how do you handle skepticism in your own personal life? Like, if you hear somebody make an outrageous claim or pass on a tidbit of misinformation, do you challenge them or do you let it go?
It's a good question. I am not a rabid purveyor of the quote-unquote truth. I'm not a bully about it. Mm-hmm. I am, by nature, a very non-confrontational person, and I take the social contract sometimes too seriously. I should be more confrontational. That being said, I often gauge my audience. If someone tells me something that they believe that I think they can be moved on, I will challenge them. But if we are just going to dive down a rabbit hole, then that's not an exercise in anything but futility to me. I'm not going to tell someone who's deeply religious what my feelings on religion are. That's not necessarily a productive conversation. I had dinner the other night with someone who believed at the beginning of dinner that the World Trade Center collapse was a conspiracy, and 15 minutes later, I had convinced them that it wasn't.
There are also a lot of emails about the 9/11 truth movement, just so you know. Lots.
Well,
and
I'm
lots
sure there are. You know, look, I feel like the need for a conspiracy is very similar psychologically to the need for a god. I think we desperately want to believe that somebody is in charge. Even if it's somebody who's working against us, it's horrifying to believe that everything is totally random. Unfortunately, I believe that that's the case.
So, callers, if you want to get into this conversation, I think we have maybe one time for one more actual physical human call. The number is 1-909-366-5330. You can Skype us at Skeptically Speaking, or you can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com. So, Adam, is there any particular pseudoscientific topic that really drives you crazy?
Oh, God, where there's a huge list of them.
The number one on Adam Savage's list of things I hate.
The ones that really get me are the ones where people are duped and separated from their money. Their alternative therapies, the idea that, there's the anti-vax boneheads. There's the anti-Western medicine, homeopathic crazy. There's free energy drives me more insane, I think, than almost any other thing. And I grant you, yes, solar power is a quote-unquote free energy. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the Joe cell. I'm talking about HHO. I'm talking about all those supposed ways in which people are claiming to get 300 miles a gallon out of their car, and they're lying. They're just lying. And when you start to dive into these things, there's plenty of information out there about it, but there's precious little about someone actually doing any of it. And, you've got people who travel the country raising money to do this. They keep talking about the conspiracy of the oil companies and stuff like that. And I'm the first one to recognize that oil companies and many corporations are venal and greedy. But it doesn't mean that in and of itself doesn't mean that this stuff works and it's being kept down by the man.
Right.
The file we had when we did an episode on free energy was 5 inches thick. It was the hugest amount of garbage we've ever had to collect from the web. And every little bit of it drove me crazy. It's great that people believe. It's also, the double-edged sword is that it's great that people believe that everybody might be wrong about something. Because it's always possible. It is always possible. It's fine to examine that.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can throw out what everyone believes simply because they might be wrong. You have to really take it seriously. And when you start to look into these things like the free energy, you'll notice that they you know, people sort of laughingly slough off things like people who believe in Einsteinian or Newtonian physics. And it's like, you're not allowed to dispel with that stuff. I mean, so I appreciate the idea that you might have the correct solution to something in your garage and figured out the secret to something. That's great. That's so much of invention comes right from people solving problems like that in their heads and trying to make them possible in the world. But it's not. You have to take seriously what has gone before. And all real science has actually done that.
We have an email. Go ahead, Ryan.
This one is from Richard Saunders. He asks, would MythBusters like to come to Australia to conduct the world's biggest ever water dowsing experiment? Would they like to come to Australia just for the hell of it?
Ah, oh, Richard, how are you? I would love to come to Australia. You know, MythBusters is actually produced by Beyond Productions right out of Sydney. And in the 7 years we've been producing the show, we have still never yet visited the mothership. And we'd love to come to Australia. Dowsing has been on our list. It falls a little bit into the Oogie Boogie territory, what my friend James Randi would call woo-woo. However, that sounds intriguing. Richard, you should email me and tell me more.
Ooh, that was lovely. I feel like I was just in on something secret. Lovely.
Oh, no. I know Richard. I mean, I've saw him at
no, I understand.
Oh, okay.
Just like a preemptive, you will be in Australia, eventually.
At some point, we will get to Australia, absolutely.
And it could be due to a conversation that occurred on Skeptically Speaking. You can't buy publicity like that, you know? So, actually, I think this may be our last question. And I received this by email before the show, and I thought it was brilliant. I had heard at Dragon Con this year you dressed up as Chewbacca. Is that true? And if so, did the most recent incarnation of Star Wars make you cry salty tears of despair for our now-ruined childhoods?
Yes and yes. Yes, I dressed up as Chewbacca. I frequent a phenomenal group of uber-exacting obsessives and geeks called the Replica Props Forum, or the RPF, online. I've been a member of the RPF since, I think, 1998. And on there, there's a guy who, I think his username is Duck. His name is Mark Quintenis, and he made himself a magnificent Wookiee suit, a Wookiee costume. And I contacted him earlier this year and asked him if he'd make me one. Well, I mean, you know, I'm paying him for it. And he did. He made me a unbelievably gorgeous Wookiee suit.
It was beautiful. I saw you in it.
It was just amazing, and I wore it to Dragon Con. I wanted to wear it longer. Unfortunately, the second day on Sunday, I didn't get a chance to get out in it. I am going to wear it on Halloween here in San Francisco to take my kids out. It is so much fun to wear that costume. It must be what it feels like to be Michael Jackson when I wear that costume out, I swear.
And that's actually all the time we have for today. Adam, that was brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show. Now, everyone listening can head over to the website at skepticallyspeaking.com and comment about how awesome Adam is. And while you're
or
there...
Or you can disagree with me and call me an idiot. I can take it.
No, there will be none of that.
Okay.
And while you're there, you can click the links to subscribe to the show in iTunes, be our Facebook friend, or follow us on Twitter. And since I have you all listening, I'm using this opportunity. Remember that Adam Savage is here because he supports skepticism, especially skepticism on desperate for money community radio stations. Right, Adam?
Hear, hear. Absolutely.
Yay. So everyone out there in audience land, be like Adam. Our fundraising campaign is supposed to start next week, but I can absolutely take your money tonight.
By the way, actually, contact me after the show. I'm good for $100.
Adam, we love you. We really, really
pleasure.
Do.
My pleasure.
So everyone that else wants to donate money, I dare you to match Adam right there. Call us at 780-492-2577, extension 8. Intern Ryan is standing by. Again, thanks very much, Adam Savage. You rule. You have been wonderful.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
And that's it for us. See you next week on Skeptically Speaking.